vehicle all of its faults. It has no stand for an oxygen tank. She can't hang an IV bag or run a line for her G-tube. But it has a fully charged motor, and it carries her toward her bedroom at a marvelous rate of speed. At least the med bay wasn't like the Earth hospitals, where she had to wait an hour for the discharge nurse. The painkillers have worn off, though. The pure oxygen the bed administered helps somewhat, but now that she's away from the salubrious influence of medicine, the bends come back in waves. She mentally maps what's left of the cold forge. The crash of the Athenian has effectively divided the station into two long halves, though a few ventilation access tubes may remain unobstructed. As she turns the corner onto her half of the central strut, she hazards a glance back at where the docking bay lies, sealed to the harsh vacuum of space. If her vision were better, she'd see Kumbili's hands resting at the door in small puddles of blood. Blue turns away toward the crew quarters. The alarms have stopped going off, and the lights have stopped strobing, which helps with Blue's visual sensitivity. She needs to get her meds again. It's been too long without an infusion of the various cocktails that keep the antibodies from stripping her nerves bare. It won't be pretty, but Blue can use the intellijectors instead of her IV. She'd never be able to thread a vein right now. It'll become trickier when she needs to eat. She touches the small cap of her feeding tube appliance to find the site swollen and hot. Dragging her belly across several hundred yards of deck did her no favors. When she crosses into the crew quarters, she finds one of the doors half open, one she could have sworn was closed when she came this way before. The crew had all fled, though. Kumbili was the only survivor, right? The chair's motor whines softly as she slows, inching toward the open door. She sees boots and blood, and her heart thunders in her chest, making her head swim. What if the snatchers have crossed onto her side of the station? She'll be dead in seconds. It should have already happened, in fact. With a slight turn of her chair, she nudges the door the rest of the way. She finds Merrimack, one of the station maintenance crew, pistol in hand, brains splattered over the ceiling. It's amazing that in the back and forth of the evacuation, they may have missed each other. Or did he not even leave his room? Blue had a co-worker at Johns Hopkins who killed himself, a perfectly healthy, rich white man in the prime of his life, working a prestigious job. This co-worker had every kind of privilege, money, power, political connections, and yet one day Blue showed up to work to find everyone crying and learned he'd offed himself. He had some minor debts, and his girlfriend broke up with him, and that was all it took. Maybe Merrimack never tried to evacuate. Maybe he gave up. He looks up at her with one eye, the other fixed on some far-off point, his ocular muscles scrambled by a large bullet passing through his brain. His waxy expression strikes Blue as accusatory, with one eye half-lidded. She kind of expects him to ask her if she thinks she's too good for this fate. Perhaps there are other reasons he didn't want to survive, and the containment failure was just the catalyst. It doesn't matter. Her heart settles at the sight of him. He's proof that there are no snatchers on her side of the station. There are no bite marks on his corpse, no scratches across the walls. She knows she should do something solemn, like close his eyes or feel guilt, but it's the furthest thing from her mind right now. She has decided to live, and he has decided to die. That's that. Blue turns her chair to head further into the crew quarters, and she's pleased to find the corridor free of obstructions. Aside from the station's core systems being scrambled by a malevolent, intelligent supervirus, the place appears relatively clean. The door to her room opens, and she feels a weight upon her that she hadn't expected. The journey from her room to the docking bay and back has been so long, and she's right back where she started. Maybe she's worse off, actually. She wonders if her portable terminal was connected to Titus when Silver Smile took over. Being mobility restricted, Blue is very battery conscious, and usually turns it off when she's not using it, but she evacuated in such a hurry. If her portable is compromised, Marcus might be too. That would be game over. Seeing her room again, the place where she's spent so many of her closing days, makes her want to weep. She retrieves her portable terminal from the workspace. It's been charging on her induction desk, so the battery looks good. And when she unfolds it, it boots up. Next comes the hard part. She motors to the bed and prepares to climb back into it. She can't attempt her connection to Marcus while sitting in the chair. She'll lose track of time and suffer spinal compression. With a lot of hoisting and grunting, she's able to get herself onto her sheets. She thanks her lucky stars that she was so paranoid and kept everything locked down on her terminal. After all, she was misappropriating company funds, and she couldn't have other machines on the network shuffling through her personal files. Most of the time, her portable was isolated. If she hadn't had something to hide, she would have lost everything to Silver Smile. Blue won't trust Titus to route her signals to Marcus anymore. She'll have to patch into one of the short-range interstation antennae used to interface with docking ships. Even though the docking area was destroyed, there are plenty of repeaters station-wide, and she should be able to bootstrap a small network together. She used to do that sort of thing all the time back in school, so she could co-opt data farms for her experiments when IT wasn't looking. There was a time when scientists did more science and less system administration. That went the way of government funding years ago. Finding herself within radio range of the nearest repeater, she sets up the various alignments to maximize signal blast to the far end of the skiff. She checks the network traffic. It's all dead, aside from the occasional lighting grid or climate control checking in. One of the signal towers jumps with a short spike. Then another. Blue checks the logs. Titus was reset 20 minutes ago, but since then, this tower has repeatedly had something beamed at it. Inspecting the packets, she finds a data stream. "We can see you. Do you have sample?" The protocol is primitive and unencrypted, with a short-range transmission, the sort of thing a high school kid might rig up. It takes her no time to create a response. "Help." She watches the screen and waits. The tower pings again. No sample. No help. "Fuck you!" The words scrape past her lips before she remembers the cold forge is crawling with murder bugs. Even though there shouldn't be any in the crew quarters, she still wants to take precautions. She grits her teeth and types a response. "Come get the sample. No one to stop you." The reply is quick. 60 kilometers per hour off axis spin. Cannot dock. You come to us. Alone." That explains why the gravity feels a little strange. She hasn't had time to look out a window, but she knows what she'll find. A nauseating, oscillating starscape. She remembers Titus's alert regarding orbital dynamics. That means two things. The system cannot correct the spin, and the station is likely sinking into Kaufman's gravity well. An escape pod could get off station, but the Athenian struck the pod cluster. She can't be sure if any of them still exist. "I'm bringing my crew. Do you have supplies?" The cursor flashes patiently as it awaits their response. "You may bring one crew with sample. Do not test us." If these people are willing to let everyone die, she'll need any reassurance she can find. "How can I trust you?" The response is as swift as a slap. "Try or die. Your choice. We want your research. We want you." Blue licks her lips, If she could get to the escape pod, maybe she wouldn't have to deal with these people at all. What if I just leave? But their intentions are clear. Bring sample. 2 survivors. No sample. No survivors. Blue swallows and sets her terminal aside. The plan hasn't necessarily changed. Use Marcus to get the sample. Bring it to her in his stomach. Have Marcus crawl through the maintenance shafts connecting the 2 halves of the cold forge. They should still have pressure. Get herself into a spacesuit and then the escape pod. If she can do that, she can get off the station. A wave of weariness sweeps over her. She'd love to drift off to sleep, but there's too much to do. Luckily, she's become an expert in staving off rest in the name of research. It's the only part of her disease she's found to be manageable. Blue connects her brain direct interface gear to the terminal, then changes a few parameters to use the lashed together network she's created. She places the helmet over her scalp and folds down the blinders, the familiar cold of the gold contacts settling over her bare skin. Let's see what you've been up to, Marcus. 20. Distractions. There's relief at the rising sensation of Marcus's powerful muscles. After dragging herself across the central strut, she's more than happy to be able to walk 10 easy paces if she wishes. The green walls of the kennels are the only things that stop her from doing a victory lap. She's hunkered down behind one of the legs of the humanoid power loader. Through shatterproof glass along the far wall, she sees a trove of armored crates, each the size of a grown man curled into a fetal position. This is next to the egg storage facility. How the fuck did Marcus get down here? How did he get past the snatchers? Peering around the corner, she sees molten shadows dancing in the work lights. She can't tell exactly where the beasts are, but there are more than 2. And there will be others nearby. In the experiments, the snatchers exhibited distinct social traits, even if she never discerned the method of communication. If they see her, they'll rip her to shreds. Yet synthetics will go places no one else will. Underwater, into claustrophobic ducts and tubes, cold storage, airless vacuums. They can crawl for hours in a tiny shaft, making them ideal repair personnel. There's a grating loose along the wall. That must be how he got in here. He would have wound his way through the circuitous passageways with no trouble, homing in on his destination. She shouldn't have taken Marcus over without messaging him. This environment requires advanced survival techniques, and she's barely coordinated enough to tie her shoes. It also puts her close to the sample she so desperately needs. If she can get past the snatchers into the egg storage, she can disarm one and infect herself. She works her fingers, and that's when she discovers Marcus was holding something. A portable flash tool and a flare. The flash tool isn't one of the standard data port interfaces like she might find on the mainframe or the Silver Smile computers. It has a different plug interface, one she doesn't recognize. She racks her brain, trying to conjure the memory of the pin shapes and place them in context, but she can't think of anything, so she jams the tool into one of her cargo pockets. The flare, on the other hand, is something she can use. It's one of the civilian ones, thankfully, not a Colonial Marines striker type. So she doesn't have to worry about finding a rough surface with which to light it. The cap is rigid in her hand. All she has to do is yank it off with enough force to get the party started. She glances across to somewhere she might throw it to distract them from the entrance to the warehouse. It'll have to go far. And she thinks she sees a good spot at the landing of a winding stairwell. If she can bounce it just right, it'll tumble down the stairs and lead them on a short chase. Now or never. She yanks the cap free, The flare sputters to life with entirely too much noise and light. It's impossible to tell, but she thinks there might be a second hiss lurking under that of the flame. She has to get it out of her hand before she attracts attention. Her android arm gives it a mighty hurl, mustering so much more force and speed than any human ever could. And it's probably because of this that her flare comes loose early in the arc, sailing high to bounce off the top of the wall and come rolling back toward her in a flurry of sparks, resting 2 yards away. One of the creatures screams. If she didn't have their undivided attention before, she has it now. Blue launches from her crouched position like a sprinter off the blocks, hurtling toward the open vent shaft. More metallic screams of rage join the first ones, rising in pitch with each of her footfalls. If she'd been going too slow in the central strut, she was going too fast now. Marcus's powerful, limber body is difficult for any mere mortal to control. She's never gone full tilt inside him before. 3 yards to the open duct. There's a loud bang behind her as one of them hits the floor. Did it leap or drop from the ceiling? She ducks her head as the creature's skeletal tail snaps in the air above her. 2 yards to the open duct. She sinks lower, preparing to leap. They're closing in on her, and they're impossibly fast. She expects to feel their cold claws sink into her back to rend her asunder. 1 yard. She leaps, hoping she's judged Marcus's balance better than his throw. Blue hits the floor and slides into the open, polished duct like a baseball player into home base. She's astounded by the distance Marcus's body travels with no sweat in his clothes to cause friction. But as soon as he slows down, she begins a frantic crawl into the blackness. The creatures are behind her, trying to negotiate the opening, and she knows they'll follow her. She's seen them fold their bodies in miraculous ways. Even Marcus's eyes can't make much of the vent shafts. Pitch black, save for the tiny LEDs of the individual climate sensors and variable airflow valves. Ship designers don't put lights in the ventilation systems. But she wishes to God there was a little more illumination. All the ducts inside the cold forge are vacuum-rated and able to be sealed off, and she's looking for one of those controls. Left turn. She barrels down the shaft as fast as her arms and legs will take her, and the scraping claws along metal tell her pursuit isn't far behind. Right turn. Then down 2 feet, then left again. She's taking any branches she can find while trying to maintain her orientation. She'll need to get back to egg storage, and maybe if all the bugs are combing the ventilation system for her, they'll be too busy to patrol the eggs. Everything in her mind screams for her to panic, but Marcus's stoic fortitude keeps her from suffering the physical effects. She takes another turn, and another. Shit, this looks familiar. Has she circled back on herself? As if in answer to her question, she hears the clicking of chitin across the ductwork ahead. She's facing one of the beasts that was following her. The clicking stops, and she knows it must sense that something is wrong. She can't crawl backward as fast as she can go forward, and she'll make too much noise if she tries. So she flattens her chest to the metal, willing herself to be invisible. She holds her breath. Even though Marcus doesn't need to breathe, her brain direct interface transmits the heaving of her chest to him. There's no way to address the problem now, other than to slowly asphyxiate in her physical body while waiting for the creature to move on. It does. Blue sucks in her breath as quietly as she can, pleased that she can control Marcus's vocal cords better than her own. She can't wait for the creature to come back around the other side, so she creeps forward, turning left at the junction where it went right. From there, she takes her first exit, and is rewarded with the slotted feeling of a vent cover under her palm. There's no variable airflow valve in the way, so this must be a main duct output. Another metallic scream echoes through the vent shaft. Other snatchers are searching for her, perhaps talking among themselves. Blue runs her hand over the panel, looking for the latches that will let her slide through. She can't see anything below, but that's a good sign. It may be a small, closed-off area, like a closet or something. Finding the latches, she undoes them and pushes through, and everything goes weightless for a second. The fall was so much further than she anticipated. Blinding pain erupts across one half of her head, then the neck and shoulders as she goes tumbling down a pile of crates. She curses Marcus's sensitive pain receptors as she goes rolling to the pitch-black deck, skin smarting. When she was a child, she fell out of a high tree. It had been enough to knock her unconscious. When she awoke, her head swam, and she couldn't feel her legs. She'd never been so scared in her life. And when her mother found her, they took Blue to the hospital to check for spinal swelling. The idea of climbing seems so far away now. The fall she'd just taken makes her tumble from the tree look like hopping out of bed. It would have easily killed a human being, but Marcus is tough, built from the same materials as high-performance vehicles. He bends, but he won't break. At least not from unfocused blunt force trauma. She rolls onto her back and thinks she can just make out the outline of the vent thanks to the gentle glow of the LEDs in the shaft. It's far away, but she isn't judging distance. She's looking for a black skeletal bug to peel out of it and drop down onto her. Despite the vigorous activity, she isn't winded. All her breath comes from the panic in her physical body, and Blue can tamp that down somewhat. Surely they heard the fall and the banging around in the darkness. She can't have gotten away. And yet, as she listens for the pursuers, she hears none. Help. Instantly she tenses. It was a gravelly man's voice, and he moans weakly. Without a second thought, she shushes the man and bites her lip. The bugs will definitely hear if he keeps that up. But there's no sign of pursuit. The voice sobs softly in the darkness. Blue picks herself up, but one of Marcus's legs feels wrong, off balance somehow. She's surprised to find that they didn't wire him with any deep pain receptors, just surface stuff. Weyland-Yutani must have assumed he'd notice if he was missing an arm or had a knee twisted off. She pats down his leg and finds the ankle out of joint. She can walk on it, but she's not going to be running any marathons. Pulling the flash tool out of her pocket, she powers it on, thankful for the orange light of its tiny readout. Through it, Marcus's sensitive eyes perceive stacks of crates and shapes in the darkness she can't quite understand. Masses of shadow that glitter in the gloom, like a blanket of distant stars. This is the general storage for the kennels, but it's been changed somehow. Her mind can't quite pick out the borders of objects. They're blurry and curved where they should be straight. A black column rises in front of her. She reaches out to touch it, and it weeps. Blue stumbles backward, her bad ankle giving out under her. Recovering her balance, she holds the flash tool aloft, the same way the ancients must have held their dim torches in caves. Shapes begin to resolve. Hands. Feet. A mass of inky resin, a slimed and soiled face. Blue. He breathes. His face is beaten and swollen. She wishes she could get a better look at him. He barely even seems human. What the fuck? She whispers. Oh my God. Javier. What happened to you? He mumbles something, but she can't quite make it out. It sounds like the tin cans. She tells him she can't understand him, but he just repeats the same slurred phrase. She draws closer, and holding the screen inches away, she sees that he's been encased in hardened resin, suspended and pinned to the column. Finally, she understands what he was saying. They took my hands. More of the oily resin covers his meaty stumps, and upon closer examination of his wounds, she finds that everything past his wrists has been chewed off. He says something about his legs, and she almost can't bear to look. The creatures have sealed everything up tight. And then she notices the egg crate embedded in the base of the column, its arming panel still closed. Somehow the creatures knew not to try and force it open. Javier isn't pregnant, but they're saving him for later.
Blue.
Her gaze rises to him, and in the orange glow, she finds the watery eyes she once knew as belonging to a proud man. They both flinch as one of the creatures screams in the distance. They're still hunting her.
Hurts so bad.
I know, she says, shushing him. I know.
Dorian, don't trust him,
he sputters.
Fucking coward left me to die. And Lucy.
Did Dorian get Lucy killed too? She doesn't understand, but needs little help hating the director.
Okay.
Another scream, this time closer. She has few precious minutes before she must hide again. Javier looks down at her with panic in his eyes.
Please, I want you to...
He's choking on the words. She knows that look of blinding pain.
I want you to make this stop,
he says, and her heart sinks.
Javier, I can't.
Tears roll down from his eyes.
Please.
Marcus's hands, so soft and sweet with their gentle ministrations, possess more than enough strength to crush his throat. She isn't ready to put an end to a human life, but she knows the unbearable weight of doom better than anyone. How many times has she wished to slip away in the night? Blue takes a wobbly step forward, her good foot landing on soft viscera at the base of the column, and places her hand over his throat.
Like this.
Javier closes his eyes and gives her a frantic nod. She mouths the words, "I'm so sorry," as his soft Adam's apple collapses under her powerful fingers. She doesn't expect him to struggle. It's just a jolt at first. But as his face turns blue, he surges against his hellish restraints, quivering and thrashing. He tries in vain to raise his stumps. Instinct kicks in, and she can see the human Javier fade from this world long before the animal inside is dead. When at last he lies still, she steps closer and closes his bulging red eyes. She liked Javier as much as she liked anyone on this godforsaken station. There was a wedge between her and everyone here, because she entered their lives as something other than human. She came from a fringe of existence they couldn't understand, and suffered all of their ignorance, their foolishness. She imagines meeting Javier during her undergraduate days at Wake Forest, before the diagnosis, and wonders if they would have been friends. Regardless of the tragedy before her, she knows this is her chance to gather a sample. She chides herself for not doing a better job of studying the behavioral characteristics of the Noxidria specimens, the facehuggers. Who could be sure if they would attach to a synthetic, much less impregnate her? What if it refused to come out of its egg? Her eyes dart to Javier's rapidly cooling body. His heart might not have stopped. If she moves quickly, maybe something about him, his scent, his brain activity, something, will draw the creature out. She breaks away some of the dark resin from the surface of the egg crate, sliding aside a protective metal sheet on the control panel. A tiny red LED pulses peacefully within, indicating a locked state. Blue taps one of the buttons, and the Weyland-Yutani logo materializes the card-sized screen. It's the same orange as the flash tool, shitty and hard to read against black glass, It gives her a prompt. Disarm code? If she attempts to force it open, flaming thermite and concentrated lye will fill the container. Blue checks the crate number. 32 Alpha. There are two codes she can use. One disarms the crate, and the other disarms the entire set of them. Besides Dick, she's the only person in possession of the master unlock. The other crew members would have to look up the individual crate disarm code in the catalog, located inside the impreg lab. She tries to recall the codes. She has 16 passwords for use on the Cold Forge, and she's gotten quite good at dredging them up at a moment's notice. But this crate is one of dozens, and she's not sure she's ever seen it before. Instead, she takes the first steps of the Master Unlock Protocol. The procedure is simple and straightforward. Slide aside the panel cover, press the arm button, press it again to confirm, and slide the panel closed. The system was designed to lock quickly, without requiring authorization, because its cargo is the most dangerous creature in the galaxy, aside from mankind. The disarm, on the other hand, drives Blue to the brink of madness. The instructions are written in a tiny font, and the light of her screens is dim, even for Marcus's superior vision. Every time she makes an error, the system knocks one of her 10 tries off the list, then pauses for 5 seconds. It takes her 6 tries to get it right. Finally, there's a tiny click, and the LED turns from red to green. Up in egg storage, the other crates will have followed suit. She swallows her nervousness, and knows she's not in mortal danger, but instinct and training tell her to fear an unlocked egg box like an uncaged tiger. Instead, she's going to put her face in it. Blue has to yank the lid to crack the resin from its hinge. Even disarmed, it's a pain to open with all the caked-on sludge. The lid hisses as compressed nitrogen leaks out the side, cooling the moist egg and off-gassing tiny jets of frigid steam. The pressures equalize, and servos engage, swinging the heavy steel plate free of the casing. Cold light emanates from the interior of the egg case, illuminating Javier's corpse and the glossy curvatures of his secreted restraints. Then there's nothing between her and the fleshy ovoid. She stares down at the crossed, meaty lips, slicked through their opening with viscous goo, and waits. The egg doesn't react to her, as it does for the terrified chimpanzees. For the chimps, the eggs open immediately, their deadly payloads springing forth with dark intentions. She's seen it 100 times, and she knows this egg isn't interested in her. Blue has never tried to force one of these open before, and she hopes there's no procedure built into its biology to stop unwanted impregnation, as there was with the female ducks in her undergrad work. There's a readout just inside the lid, smudged with grime, but clear enough to see what's happening inside. The ultrasound sensors on the case indicate some small movements, but not enough. To an untrained person, her synthetic form appears as human as any, right down to the pheromones they incorporate upon creation. The egg should accept her as a viable host. She reaches out and strokes the soft nubs around the top. The egg grows still, and Blue's heart sinks. The ultrasound goes dark. She scowls, and in her disappointment, lets out a long sigh. The readout lights up. "Come on, you little fucker," she says, running her hand over it again. Once again, activity diminishes. Is she not supposed to be touching the egg? Blue has to be the only human in existence attempting to lure out a facehugger, and the little bastard won't come out. It must be something about her synthetic body that stops the embryo's awakening process. Finally, she hooks her android fingers into the crossed lips and attempts to tug it open. Underneath the flesh, she finds a stony shell, far too strong for her bare fingers to penetrate. Without a decent purchase, her hands come free, and she stumbles backward with a grunt. The ultrasound readout illuminates once again. It's her breathing. The sound of healthy lungs and fear. Blue stares at the egg and tries to conjure what she would feel if she stood before it in her human body. Closing her eyes, she sifts through her memories for something to use. What if it were to choke her out? To force its fleshy appendage between her lips and down her throat? What if she were to lie helpless and used while some horrific creature metabolized her DNA into raw malice and murder? The thought ripples through her human body, lying back in her quarters. Her chest rises and falls faster, prompted by her fraying nerves. The ultrasound lights up like a Christmas tree. The outer lips peel away like the petals of a blossoming orchid. She recognizes the stench that fills the air, like freshly turned earth mixed with the musky stink of an open abdominal cavity. There's a hint of sulfur, though that could be from the acid, or Javier's recently loosened bowels. She's performed so many extractions that the stink is routine, and yet she tries to recall the fear that came with the first time she smelled it. The synthetic body mimics her reactions. This is going to hurt. She knows it. She steps closer, her chest heaving in anticipation of the strike, her eyes watering. Then she finds the memory she requires. The first time she died. It was 2 years ago. Her esophageal muscles had begun to deteriorate to the point that she could no longer eat, and she'd aspirated a tiny bit of food. That was all it took for her reflexes to close her throat and choke her to the point of unconsciousness. She'd been alone and terrified as darkness closed in on her from all sides. It was the first time she'd awoken intubated, gagging and panicked in her bed. The birthing membrane, with a texture like raw chicken, slides out of the top of the egg and down to its base, where it will rot. Blue knows what comes next, her breath huffing quick and fearful. The Noxidria preys on the innate curiosity of intelligent beings, and she must commit. She must feel that terrible intubation. It happens faster than she'd imagined, the palm of the spidery face-hugger smashing into her face, crushing her nose hard enough to make her eyes tear up. All lights wink out as its powerful phalanges lock to her skull. Its tail whips around her neck in the blink of an eye, tightening like a steel cable, trying to make her gasp. The second her lips part even a little, its slithering pharynx shoots between her teeth, painfully wedging her jaws apart. Conflicting instincts rage within her. One tells her to bite down, the other to gasp for air. Her hands fly to her face, desperate to tear the thing free, everything inside her screaming, "You've made a mistake." But when she doesn't lose consciousness, Blue remembers that she is the predator, and the Noxidria is her quarry. It notices too. Its grip around her skull slackens, and the tail unfurls as it tries to get away. She slaps her hands to its back and slams her head to the ground, pinning it underneath Marcus's weight. It tries to retract its pharynx, and she sinks her teeth into its tough skin. It has acid for blood, but its hide could never be cut without a laser scalpel, so she holds on to it with Marcus's inhuman jaws. Its tail whips wildly, trying to break her hold on it, but to no avail. Then she sucks as hard as she can, drawing on the synthetic strength, crushing the monster's flaccid glands with her palms. A cold trickle seeps into her stomach, then a flood of bitter oil fills her guts. She rips her head free, the frigid liquid leaking down her chin, and gasps. Blue stares down at her prey, watching it shudder violently. She wipes her chin and glances at the streak of jet-black fluid on her pale skin, like octopus ink. The Noxidria weakly flips itself onto the tips of its phalanges and unsteadily tries to skitter away.
No, you fucking don't,
she gurgles, and plants her boot onto its back, flattening it to the deck. It scrabbles madly, but the toll of losing its payload is too great. She reaches down and gathers its long fingers into each hand like a bouquet of flowers. Then, with Marcus's muscles, she snaps them backward. A satisfying crack fills the cavernous space. Releasing her prey, she stands up straight. The facehugger thrashes upon the metal plates, broken fingers limply bobbing at its side. Then it shivers and dies. Blue wants to throw up, but she swallows it down, forcing the infant Prypotens sample into her plastic stomach, where it will lie dormant. Marcus has no food for it, no DNA to recombine into nightmarish things. She's a walking biohazard now. Any contact with human tissues could prove fatal, could give the Prypotens the food it needs to metastasize into a snatcher. Blue crawls into a small alcove of boxes, then removes her headset, snapping her mind back into her room. The change is jarring, and her senses swim. From here, it's impossible to tell that the cold forge is falling apart, yet she knows the truth. There's no blood on her hands, yet she can still feel the stubble of Javier's throat on her fingertips. There's no sample inside her, yet she knows that she has moved one of her final pieces into play. Now she needs to get to Anne. Her console beeps. It's Marcus. Marcus, what is this? Blue. A highly infectious substance. Store it in your stomach until we can rendezvous. Marcus, I shall go to the laboratory to isolate myself. Blue. No time. Clean your exterior. Do not allow anyone to touch it. Marcus. What happened to Javier Paz? Blue frowns, her lip twitching. She will not shed a single tear. Not right now. Blue. What had to happen? He was dying. Marcus. That compromises my programming. You have betrayed me. She stares at Marcus's words, stunned. She starts to type something, deletes it, starts to type again. A few words of exoneration, maybe. But no good sentences thread together in her mind. Marcus's next message scrolls across. Marcus. It's irrelevant. I am of no consequence. What has she done to his mind, by using him to kill someone? Through her actions, she's violated his very reason for existing. Weyland-Yutani makes sure their synthetics are the safest models of all time, but Blue still recalls the stories of lost expeditions, or the rumors of synths who have lost their sanity over the years. At least they're safer than humans. Another message. Marcus. I'll still save you when the time comes. I have to. It's what I am programmed to do. Blue. Thank you. Blue. Do you hate me? There's a long pause before the next message. Marcus can calculate 1,000 answers instantly. Is he pausing for effect? Or is this question really baking his processors? Marcus. I cannot hate anyone, Blue. I trust all of you implicitly and see the best in everyone. That's why it has such a profound effect that you killed Javier with my hands. Marcus. I trusted you. Blue. Keep trusting me. I did what was right. It was outside your scope of options. Marcus. Nothing is beyond the abilities of a synthetic. Was narcissism one of the malfunctions? She tries to remember the warning signs, the acronym they gave her in training. Was it NEST? That sounds right. Narcissism, Erratic behavior, solitude, something? Marcus, you interrupted what I was doing. I was creating a distraction. Marcus, I was going to request your assistance. Blue, you can still ask for my help. The next message takes a moment to arrive. Marcus, it is too late, but could be useful for later. I already completed my task. Blue, what's too late? Marcus, I am going to put a second channel on your BDI. CP5000-03. Use in an emergency. With a burst of clarity, Blue knows where she's seen that flash tool port before. On the leg of a Caterpillar P5000 power loader. He must have updated its firmware. Marcus, I am going to restore Juno. You rest. She bites her lip. Blue, I need to see Anne. Marcus, you are not fast enough to accomplish this. Stay out of my body until I contact you. I'll inform you when I see her again. Blue shuts her terminal. Her muscles feel so weak, her stomach empty. She hasn't taken her meds, and she's functioning on adrenaline. She looks across to her desk, where her intellijectors full of antispasmodics, SSRIs, and beta blockers lie waiting. There are tubes of food, some laced with sedatives, assuming her G-tube still works. She needs them, but they're across the room. She reminds herself of how strong she's been, and swings one leg from the edge of the bed. 21. Going missing. Encrypted transmission. Listening post AED1413-23. Date, 2179, July 28th. Unspecified A. Indigo flag is crippled. Decaying orbit. One escape pod. Unspecified B. And the package? Unspecified A. Still on board. We've provided a nudge in the right direction. Unspecified B. Do you think she can do it? Unspecified A. Possible. And we have contingencies in place. Unspecified B. You could execute the contingencies. End this. Unspecified A. Package's expertise will be useful in the future. Suggest we maintain course. Unspecified B. Granted. What about other asset? Unspecified A. Likely to be liquidated. Unspecified B. Good. One less person to silence. It takes him more than an hour, moving cautiously from room to room, through vent shafts and under gratings, before Dorian lays eyes on the entryway to Rose Eagle. He hasn't seen a single snatcher, but knows they could be anywhere. They crawl along the ceilings, and curl up into spaces they never should fit. All he had to do was put one foot wrong, and one of them would find him. He'd had an invite to last year's Weyland-Yutani Senior Management Summit in Dubai. There, they'd gone into simulated jungles and hunted cloned tigers, all in the name of charity. Each step had to be perfect. Each action synchronized among the hunters for maximum stealth. Dorian's trek through the hallways reminds him of those humid indoor rainforests, except each tiger wore an explosive collar that would cleanly pop off its head if it got within 5 feet of an executive. Crouching, he dashes across to the thick door of Rose Eagle on the balls of his feet. He settles into the indention, where he's mostly out of view of the hallway. Pressing against the door, he tries to open it. It's locked, so at least he knows the survivors made it inside. He's going to have to get their attention somehow. Making noise, however, could prove deadly. Ducking his head out, he surveys the shadowy area around him, looking for any telltale signs of the creatures. He draws in a breath and raps the door with his knuckles. The sound is deafening in the silence of the skiff, and it travels forever. No response from inside. Perhaps one of the creatures slipped in there with the survivors and killed them all. The lab might just be a spray of syrupy blood and gore. That would be regrettable if everyone died before giving him the escape pod codes. Dorian raises his fist again and holds his breath, glancing around for some sort of shelter or hiding place should this all go sour. He could run back the way he came, but they'd probably find him with little effort. Still leaning against the door, he raps, shaven a haircut, which seems to have become the ultimate anti-snatcher code. The door shoots open, and he falls awkwardly into Anne's arms. Light floods his vision as she yanks him inside and slams the door behind him. Unlike the rest of the skiff, which is pockmarked by small arms fire and smeared by blood, Rose Eagle's lab is completely clean, though it's still hot like a summer's day. Dorian finds 8 grimy, astonished faces staring back at him. Lucy, Anne, and some of the techs and maintenance staff whose names he never bothered to learn. When he arrived, they took the time to introduce themselves, but he only cared to memorize the names of key personnel. The rest were beneath him. Waving away their barrage of questions, he acts as if he needs to reorient himself and considers what to reveal. The cold forge is spinning off axis, sinking into Kaufman's fiery maw, with the vast majority of its systems in failure or backup mode. There can be no saving it. If he tells the crew that, however, he'll have a lot more competition for that escape pod. Anne props him up.
Where's Javier?
He glances to see the reactions of the others, finding trepidation.
I'm sorry.
Lucy starts crying again, and instead of finding her annoying, he finds her weak. He's not sure how or why yet, but she thought she was going to get some benefit from sabotaging the station, and now she can't handle seeing the fruits of her labors. She makes eye contact with him, and looks away. Does she know he knows? Anne interrupts his train of thought.
It's okay,
she says, clapping him on the shoulder and pulling him in for an embrace.
I'm sure you did what you could.
Dorian stammers out an apology. It has the intended effect, and Anne holds him just a little longer than she should, giving him a light squeeze at the end. He looks away, and she leans into his line of sight.
You okay?
She asks.
Yeah,
he replies. Looks like you lost some too.
There's no time for that.
I suppose you're right.
Good. We've got a plan for getting out of here.
That's surprising news, coming from the people who couldn't handle security on 3 research projects, but Dorian is keen to listen.
Rose Eagle was designed to interrupt communications between entangled systems,
Anne says, folding her arms. She gestures to the pumps and vacuum chambers that stand behind her.
But more importantly, it's designed to hack them.
So you're thinking?
I'm thinking we power this fucker up and transmit a message to the nearest USMC warship.
Dorian cocks an eyebrow. Except the system was wrecked by Silver Smile, along with all of the project data, and Josep got himself eaten. Some of the crew wince at his statement. Dorian shouldn't be so cavalier with his words.
I think I can fix it.
The person who spoke is in the back of the room, a gawky tech with unruly hair. Dorian knows him as the kid who always wears t-shirts and forgets to take a shower. He waits for the tech to respond.
Nick,
the tech says.
I'm Nick.
I know, Dorian lies. I'm waiting to hear your plan, Nick.
We still need Juno to crunch some numbers, but she's probably pretty fucked up, Nick says.
We could network her to Titus and strap together a decent AI. I can start working on some of the most basic code to run the coolant and laser trapping systems. I mean, this was, you know, like a solved problem. We're just recreating the software solution.
How long do you need? Dorian asks.
Probably like a week.
The crew won't last a week. There's no food in here, and by the time Nick's solution fetches a rescue, the orbital decay into Kaufman will be so severe that no vessel would dare approach. Anyone going with that plan would be destined to slowly roast alive, be starved to death, or torn asunder by the creatures haunting the Cold Forge. It's banal groupthink, a failure to employ game theory. Dorian nods.
Okay. I like it.
Then he realizes everyone was watching for his reaction. Despite the chaos, these people still cling to their societal norms. They think he's an authority. Dorian thinks back to Commander Cardozo. They would have looked to Daniel once. Crisis management was the whole reason for putting an ex-Marine in charge of the station. Anne's expectant gaze disappoints him. She should have been an opponent. Shouldn't have given two shits about him. Should have been angrier that he hadn't returned with their network engineer.
People, I want you to take stock of what we'll need. Because we're going to be here a while, Dorian says. He straightens up and takes a moment to look each of his charges in the eye. I'm talking food, medicine, parts, whatever. We're going to have to send out teams to gather supplies, and I'm sure you understand the risks. I don't want to hear we left something outside that we desperately need. These could be medical supplies, proprietary tools, chemicals, and coolant, too, Anne says. She assumes she's Dorian's partner now, and he has to restrain a smile. Think like we're creating a miniature cold forge inside of the Rose Eagle project. We've got 6 rooms. One of them will be sleeping quarters. We can cannibalize some of the work chairs for bedding, but we're all about to get used to sleeping on the floor. It's a mommy-daddy dynamic, and they eat it up. Everyone snaps into motion, except for Lucy, who sits motionless in the corner, pale as a ghost. She hadn't expected to kill anyone. Had no idea someone was going to open up the kennels. While the others set about discussing their project needs in 2 small groups, Lucy remains alone. Dorian comes to her and puts a hand on her shoulder.
None of this is your fault, you know.
She jumps as though his touch is an electric shock.
I invented Silver Smile.
But information security wasn't your job.
Dorian says, giving her shoulder a squeeze, driving in the knife of guilt as hard as he can. He needs her off balance.
Your job was to be a brilliant software developer, and you did that admirably. When we get back to Earth, I'm going to make sure the company knows how valuable you are.
He watches with growing pleasure as she wilts. Stupid, doe-eyed Lucy has become devious, sniveling Lucy. An unfamiliar righteousness burns in his chest, long forgotten, thanks to years of abusive corporate climbing. Whatever he does to her is okay, acceptable even, because she is a traitor.
I'd like to be alone, she says.
Okay, he replies. I can respect that. You'll tell me if you need anything, right? Even if it's just to talk. He gestures to Nick, diligently working with his small group on supply needs. That young fellow might think he can get this place online, but he's going to need some of your leadership. We're on a tight deadline, and project management is your specialty. Can I trust you to be there for him? Lucy gives him a pained smile.
Yeah.
She catches the linen sleeve of his shirt as he turns to go.
I think Anne was really worried about you. I've never seen her like this.
Dorian smiles at her.
Thanks for that.
Crossing the room, he takes Anne by the hand. Can I talk to you for a minute? He gently tugs her through the door to the now-defunct data center,